Support for this On the Media podcast comes from Audible.com, provider of digital audiobooks and more, across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. More at audiblepodcast.com/onthemedia.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
I'm too shy to talk to you, so I just Google your name. Google your name.
Consider this golden oldie. For everyone that asketh, receiveth, and he that seeketh, findeth, and to him that knocketh, it shall be open. Remember who said that? No problem. Just ask. Seek and knock online. In other words, Google it. This hour, we will explore the many ways in which Googleth, for better or worse, starting with the implications of its gargantuan size. For years, the world's dominant search engine has been in the crosshairs of antitrust watchdogs seeking a level playing field for competitors. Currently, Google faces a Federal Trade Commission investigation and ongoing European government probes. But so far, says Danny Sullivan, proprietor of the website Search Engine Land, no one can find any proof that Google is strong-arming its competitors.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of their biggest defenses that they continue to say, that people are voluntarily choosing them. If they don't want to use them, it's not like they have to install a new operating system. They can simply go use another search engine quite easily. Google has done deals with companies to become the default search engine, as just as Microsoft has done, but there's been no suggestion that they've somehow strong-armed their way into making that happen. They simply dropped enough cash to make it appealing.
That said, some websites like Yelp and TripAdvisor have said that essentially Google has done two things. Number one, steal their content for their own Google Places service. What's Google Places?
It's Google's local search engine.
And secondly, that they actually put Google Places links in their search results above Yelp or TripAdvisor, even if organically the results shouldn't shake out that way.
People go to Google all the time and search for local information. So Google decided that it makes sense for them to run their own local search engine. That's not unusual. Yahoo had their own local search engine. And as part of creating that, they have actually tapped into some of these other local search engines that are out there and provided links to them. But then there's just this bigger issue that some people feel like if you do a search at Google, if they suggest that you go into their local search engine, then somehow they're favoring their local search engine over other local search engines and then shouldn't be allowed.
Is there anything about Google, particularly because it is so enormous, that you are worried about and you think we should be worried about as well?
The things that I've heard expressed about Google on antitrust grounds don't resonate with me. I tend to think that those are not actually legitimate concerns and they probably wouldn't hold up, and they only seem to be getting investigated by people who really don't understand how search engines work. One argument is that Google is not supposed to have its own vertical search engines over others. It's as if you said that the New York Times, because it has its own entertainment section and its own sports section and its own business section, is being unfair to the Wall Street Journal and the Los Angeles Times. And that when you buy your New York Times, you really should have a choice if inside of it you get business from the Wall Street Journal and a sports section from the LA Times, if that's what you would prefer. That maybe that's what consumers would love to be able to do, but the New York Times has put out a complete newspaper that it thinks provides the best information in these areas. So when Google runs a vertical search engine, it's as if people are saying, well, even though you do this web search stuff, we think that images ought to be coming from Bing, or that we think that your local results ought to come from Yelp, and so you should be using them instead. And if you take that to its ultimate conclusion, then it means that any kind of search you do on Google should just be leading you off to somebody else's search engine rather than leading you to destination sites.
It sounds to me that you're pretty comfortable with where Google stands in the marketplace, that you don't think the government should be paying special attention to it just on the grounds of its enormous size. Is that your view?
I think that what worries me about Google is that when you have so many people searching on your search engine, when you have so many websites that are using your analytical code or your payment systems, you're receiving so much information about what people may like or not like that it can be difficult for competitors to have as complete a picture and then perhaps come up with a rival product. That's of a concern to me. As a company, I also tend to get nervous when they go into some of these new areas that just seem radically off the mark of what they're supposed to be doing as a – well, not even in the idea of organizing the world's information. The automated driving cars are very cool, and I have been in them. They still remain a mystery to me as to how they fit in with Google's greater glory. Perhaps we'll see. But I don't know that I need the government to step in and say to Google, oh, and by the way, you can't do automated driving cars either.
Hey, as long as they stay out of the media criticism game, I'm cool.
Yeah, I don't think they have any plans.
Danny, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Danny Sullivan is the editor-in-chief of Search Engine Land. He's also co-founder and chief content officer for Third Door Media. You may remember Google causing a bit of pan-continental brouhaha last year when it came out that the cars they were using to take pictures for their popular Google Street View application also happened to be picking up information about wireless networks they were passing by. A lot more information, it turns out, than people were comfortable with. What started as a public relations headache for the company is now a class action lawsuit arguing that Google is guilty of wiretapping. Here to discuss the potential ramifications of the case is senior editor of Ars Technica, Nate Anderson. Nate, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So the Google Street View cars go down the street, and what are they gathering as they do that?
They have a set of special cameras mounted on top of the cars that grab pictures of the homes and businesses they drive past. But they also were using for a while Wi-Fi connectivity to sense wireless networks in the area around them. So that, for instance, if your Android phone sensed a particular network in a particular area, the system could translate that into a specific set of coordinates. It is Google's attempt to build its own Wi-Fi geolocation service.
So the worst case is that Google sends its camera cars down your street, and while it's sniffing your geolocation, it also can actually capture and, let's say, read the emails that you are sending out on Wi-Fi or monitor what you are downloading, including, who knows what, porn.
Right. That's the claim that's being made in this consolidated wiretap case, that Google's Street View cars captured complete usernames, passwords, and even entire email messages.
Now, there's no evidence that Google actually went into this data to see what these data packets contained, right?
Google has described the system as a mistaken bit of code that was a leftover from something else they were trying to do. It grabbed up more data than it should have and eventually sent to the company, but it does not appear, and I've seen no evidence to suggest, that anyone at the company has ever tried to go through it, figure out what's in it, or use it for any malicious means.
Google has asked a judge to dismiss the case, but not on the grounds that it has never really gone into these packets to see what they contain, emails or whatever. They've said they weren't breaking any wiretapping laws because this was all openly available to anybody in these neighborhoods.
Right. Google claims that when its cars passed open Wi-Fi networks and they grabbed part of the signal, that was just the same as somebody taking a radio scanner and tuning into police or fire transmissions. The signals were open, they're being broadcast through the air. It can't possibly be a wiretap act violation to grab the signal.
But the judge said, nope, sorry, I'm not buying that. He believes that Google had special capabilities that just anybody doesn't have. What kind of capabilities was he referring to?
So the judge drew a distinction between accessing a radio signal that is open to the general public and one in which you have to bring extra tools to access the data being transmitted. So in this case, Google was using something called packet sniffing software, which grabs the actual packets being sent over the air by a user's computer to their router and records them. The judge said that this was not widely available technology and that grabbing that really crossed the line. While the judge made it sound like packet sniffing software is difficult to use and esoteric, it's actually quite common. Many versions of it can be downloaded free of charge from the internet.
What's the best guess for how this proceeds?
In covering these kinds of cases, I've seen very, very few that actually go to trial and reach any sort of verdict. So my guess is, since the judge has allowed this claim to continue, the case will probably be settled between the parties out of court down the road.
How does this fit into the narrative of what Google means to our lives?
Well, there's an emerging narrative around Google that its engineering, algorithmic, numerically focused culture is perhaps not always sensitive to what I guess you would label emotional concerns about issues like privacy and security. And people are increasingly uncomfortable with that stance. And it's not just Google. You saw this with Apple, which got into hot water earlier this year over geolocation issues surrounding the iPhone. So I think it's a real issue for the engineering mindset in general, which likes to do cool things, which likes to implement them in the slickest way possible, but which often thinks, I'm not going to do anything wrong with this information. Why would it bother people?
Weirdly, though, Google's main business, again, is search. And the search business doesn't really rely much on all of the data that Google is collecting on behalf of these other applications. Search is still contextual relevance plus linkage, you know, and maybe a little bit of location and search behavior.
Right, but it's coming together very quickly. The ads that you see are linked to some of the data about you. Google often suggests things now based on your location. It suggests mapping results based on things that you have typed in. And it even allows you to vote on certain results that are most relevant to you. So it is certainly building this capability to use all the data about you to shape the results that are given to you. And that can be very powerful force for good. I think it's going to be a question of, are people comfortable with that and the protections that are put around that? Because it is much better than just undifferentiated search where everyone gets exactly the same results.
Nate, thank you.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Nate Anderson is the senior editor of Ars Technica.
Coming up, Google Maps inflamed disputes all over the world.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Google Street View, which gives users a sidewalk perspective in 27 countries, faces its stiffest opposition in Germany, where Google has been in turbulent negotiations with privacy regulators for years. Last November, when the service launched in 20 German cities, people there were given the option to blur their houses out, and some 244,000 homes, or roughly 3% of households, were, in fact, blurred. Reaction was so vehemently negative that in April, Google announced that it would abandon plans to expand Germany's Street View program. Reporter Michael Bernstein examined the issue from Germany's streets last summer. It was a great piece, so we'll replay that now.
A ponytailed teacher dressed in black stands in front of a classroom of 10th graders in the small central German city of Mainz. He asks them to look up their names online, discusses their social networking habits, and directs them to an ominous-looking website called whattheinternetknowsaboutyou.com. This is internet privacy education, a growing trend in Germany, and at least in this classroom, the lesson seems to be taking.
Do you speak English a little bit?
A little bit.
What's your name?
Yes, it's private.
In a country where hanging out in the park naked is a weekend pastime, Germany has recently made international headlines for its virtual prudishness. American tech companies are under close scrutiny. Facebook was threatened with fines if it didn't tighten its privacy controls. Apple's iPhone 4 raised concerns over collection of user data. And then, of course, there was that enormous brouhaha over Google Street View.
Evaluieren in Google Street View schließen.
Das Problem mit den Google Street View Bildern.
Nach dem Start von Street View in Deutschland weitergehen.
What makes Germany particularly important for these companies is its size and wealth. With 82 million people, it has the largest economy in Europe. But Germans care more than most about what happens to their data. This may sound like your run-of-the-mill Berlin rave, but it's actually the Freedom Not Fear demonstration. Thousands of people come together every year to protest government and corporate surveillance online. Protesters carry signs saying things like, 1984 is now, and keep your hands off my data. Carolyn Geller was among the marchers.
We have the feeling that we are watched from everywhere. We just want to express that we don't say yes to that. It's like this ominous thing, and you don't know really what is done with it.
Germany's data protection movement has had a storied history. In the 80s, there was a public outcry when the West German government tried to take a census. Many citizens felt like it was too intrusive and sued. Germany's constitutional court ruled the census was unconstitutional because it violated the right to informational self-determination. The decision was based on the belief that people are not free unless they know that data from one part of their life won't leak into another.
As I'm sitting here, I'm talking to you as a scientist. Yeah? But at the same time, I'm a tango dancer.
Law professor and tango dancer Gerrit Arung is an example of a man who doesn't want his lives to intermingle.
If I'm going tango dancing, people may be frightened if they know that I'm a lawyer. People tend to not like that. So I have a personal interest to separate these two roles. Yeah? And so this is one example of reasoning which the court tried to build into the judgment.
Aware of the court's dim view of privacy intrusions, when Google announced Street View's national rollout, it not only gave Germans the right to opt their homes and businesses out, but it also launched a massive media campaign to assure the public that other privacy controls, like the blurring out of faces and license plates, are also part of Street View. Still, recent surveys have found that anywhere from 16 to more than 50% of people don't want their homes on the service. Google Germany spokesman Kay Oberbeck.
Definitely one of the reasons we see why privacy is really a sensitive topic is the history of two totalitarian regimes here in Germany.
The Nazi regime was notorious for scrupulous data collection, and the Stasi, the East German secret police, was so pervasive that some estimate that it ultimately involved 1/6 of the population. But for many Germans, the concern has less to do with a totalitarian past and more to do with their socioeconomic future. Berlin Data Protection and Freedom of Information Commissioner Alexander Dix should know. He fields many calls from Germans angry about Street View.
I can perfectly understand people who say, I do object to it, and I want to have a right to prevent Street View publishing such pictures, because the house, the car in front of the house, or the way in which I keep my front garden orderly or disorderly is something which tells something about me. Employers may be looking at the vicinity in which you live. Banks may be looking at this information in order to score your credit application to decide whether you will be likely to repay your debts.
In an Italian restaurant in a quiet Hamburg neighborhood, a group of apartment house tenants gathered to discuss whether to blur their building on Google Street View.
The apartment is my private sphere, and I know that it is a safe room for me, where I can behave as I want to, without thinking about outside influences. Perhaps Google Street View takes that from me.
Why aren't the Americans worried? From an American perspective, it's of course somehow logical to say, why are you thinking about it so much? But for me, this also raises the question of why they aren't thinking about it.
Germans tend to understand their privacy interests very differently from the way Americans understand their privacy interests. The concept of privacy that we find in Europe has to do with the protection and control of one's image.
Yale Law School professor James Whitman says this idea has roots in Europe's legacy of dueling. When private details went public in the past, nobles challenged the leaker to a duel with a sword or pistol. An invasion of privacy, after all, was an attack on one's honor. Today in Germany, weapons have been replaced by strict privacy laws. And while many Germans may think the laws were made in reaction to their totalitarian past, in fact, Whitman says, quite the contrary.
The Nazis insisted on privacy in the German sense. Every member of the national community had a right to dignity, including members of the lowest social status. The fact that fascists made this promise belonged to their competition with communist movements. What the Nazis were saying was that where they would not redistribute wealth, they would nevertheless redistribute honor.
Of course, this was done at the cost of persons whose honor was systematically destroyed by the Nazis in the most horrific way imaginable.
Nevertheless, there's a paradox. ordinary low-status Germans acquired a right to protection of their personal honor during the Nazi period that they had barely enjoyed before the Nazi period, and this has continued down to this day.
Joachim Savelsberg, professor of sociology at the University of Minnesota, says German privacy concerns may also have to do with the country's Prussian roots.
In Prussia, being very much influenced by Lutheran thought with the two-kingdom theory, there's the world of public life, of the state, of markets, and then there's the private sphere where friendship, forgiveness, cozy relationships predominate.
Maybe this separation explains Germany's fondness for high hedges and thick drapes, whereas America is arguably more influenced by its Calvinist tradition.
And indeed, in Calvinism, there was not this separation between private sphere and public life, because the individual was someone whose every move was observed by God and who could not ever hide between a thick hedge. There was no protection against that big brother called God.
But today, it's the littler brothers that are worrying Germany. And it's not just American tech companies. For instance, one man is planning to do a crowdsourcing project to take and post a picture of every building that's been blurred on the Street View map. Since there's no specific law that prohibits taking pictures of houses from the sidewalk, there's very little stopping him. Curbing anarchy on the net is hard. In front of the Brandenburg Gate, a lone saxophone is right on tune. Germany wants to do technology its own way. It wants innovations with limitations. But ultimately, even in Germany, the market will probably win out. Facebook, Apple, and Google search are all very popular. A German kid standing nearby tells me why he likes Street View.
Some people can fly to New York, and you can see the streets in New York, and that's cool.
Exactly. It's cool. In fact, Germans of all ages seem to love looking at the streets of other countries, which means they're very much in tune with at least one popular American notion, known in the United States as NIMBY. We love what you're doing, only not in my backyard. For On the Media, I'm Michael Bernstein.
So if Google runs afoul of privacy on the micro-mapping level, it runs afoul of politics in the realm of macro-mapping. In February of 2010, a top Cambodian official wrote Google a letter complaining about one of its maps. He charged that Google's depiction of a stretch of border between Cambodia and Thailand was, quote, devoid of truth and reality and professionally irresponsible. Cambodia requested that Google, quote, withdraw the already disseminated, very wrong and not internationally recognized map and replace it. As Washington Monthly editor John Gravois noted last year in a piece called The Agnostic Cartographer, 21st century map making can be politically and culturally fraught. John, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much.
Tell me about the state of Arunachal Pradesh in the far northeast of India and what Google did to it one day last August.
Well, Arunachal Pradesh has been a source of pretty nasty dispute between China and India since 1914, when the British rulers of India negotiated a treaty with Tibet, which was at the time de facto independent. So China now, which runs Tibet, doesn't acknowledge that agreement that established Arunachal Pradesh as an Indian state.
So what did Google do to it?
So last August, a weekday, everything's quiet on the internet. And then suddenly, Google Maps changes all the place names in Arunachal Pradesh into Chinese.
Now, how did this happen?
It's a mystery. A lot of angry Indian bloggers suspected immediately that Google and China were conspiring together. Others suspected that Chinese hackers broke in and changed the names in the database. But a blogger by the name of Stefan Gienz, who runs a wonderful site that keeps track of border disputes in the age of Google Earth, came up with another theory. He pointed out that Google maintains a separate map site for China and a separate map site for India. According to Chinese law, all maps have to represent what the Indians call Arunachal Pradesh as South Tibet. Stefan Gienz, this blogger, posited that the names on the Chinese map must have somehow switched over into the names on the global map that we all look at.
Let's go back to the golden era of mapmaking during the European colonial era of the 1800s. What was the philosophy then, so to speak, behind cartography?
The whole mapmaking enterprise supported the expansion of European powers out into unfamiliar territory. Mapmaking was also something that came under this sort of industrial era, progressive-minded idea that everything can be measured, the world can be indexed, we can narrow down to a clear account of pretty much everything. The colonial era came crashing to an end, and with that, mapmaking changed. State-run data collection efforts went by the wayside gradually. Satellites started to take their place.
But as you note, there's a lot that we can't get from satellites. That's where Google comes in with its MapMaker tool, which any person can use. How does it work?
Google has set up a pretty straightforward, user-friendly platform called Google MapMaker that allows people in hitherto unmapped parts of the world to just enter in information about the place where they live. There's also a thing called the community layer of Google Earth, which is just like a bulletin board that's tagged to a map. And in Israel, a Palestinian user of Google Earth was going around and tagging different towns as what he said were the sites of former Palestinian villages destroyed in the 1948 creation of Israel. And he tagged a town called Kiryat Yam as one of those villages. The people in Kiryat Yam were very upset by this. They said, in fact, our town was founded on barren sand dunes, and you've basically slandered us.
Another Google-fueled cartographic controversy is over what to call that body of water between Iran and the Arabian Peninsula.
For years and years and years and years, that body of water has been known as the Persian Gulf. But in the 1960s, there was a movement in Arab countries to call it the Arabian Gulf. This arose with Arab nationalism and was promoted by Saddam Hussein, among many, many other people.
And obviously, Persia is a reference to Iran, which is not an Arabic nation, and Iran took this very personally.
That's putting it lightly. It's been a big dispute for decades now. In 2004, National Geographic issued a new edition of its main atlas and included the name Arabian Gulf as an alternate name in parentheses and small print. The Iranians staged huge email campaigns, letter-writing campaigns, street protests. In Iran itself, all National Geographic products were banned, boycotted. And at the time, one of the largest Google bombs to date was created in response to it as well, where if you searched for the term Arabian Gulf on Google, the top result was a website that looked like an error message that said, "I'm sorry, the Gulf you're looking for doesn't exist. Please try Persian Gulf."
Now, Google took the National Geographic route, essentially, didn't it, by listing both names?
Yes. On Google Earth, if you go to the Gulf, you'll see in equal-sized text, Persian Gulf near Iran and Arabian Gulf near Qatar and Bahrain and the UAE and Saudi Arabia. So Google isn't taking the National Geographic route in one respect, which is that it's not backing down.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the largest online petitions on the internet today is a petition that demands the immediate and unconditional deletion of Arabian Gulf from Google Earth. And what's interesting about the petition is that it attacks Google for not adhering to the standards of cartography that might have been espoused by 19th century mapmakers. The Iranian petition accuses Google of not obeying international standards. Google's response was really interesting. A couple months after the petition went live, they posted a kind of statement about how they decide what to name things. And the statement made no mention of history, made no mention of international standards. They just said, "We name bodies of water according to the names that countries adjoining that body of water use." There's no science except for the science of just finding out what people say.
So what do you think about Google's repudiation of history and tradition?
Well, it follows a pretty standard kind of philosophy of the internet era, which is, you know, the more information, the better. The more democratic the production of information, the better. But Google gets itself into trouble. Google is now producing the world's most important map. That used to be something nation states did. And what's happening in all these geographic disputes is that Google's getting confused with a nation state, and not just anyone, a really important one, a powerful one. In all of these conflicts, you see parties to these disputes accuse Google of being geopolitical conspirators. The whole time, Google is kind of shrugging and saying, we're showing as many claims as possible, trying to be neutral.
This is what people are calling neo-geography, where we can layer our maps with all kinds of information. Doesn't that raise the question, what is it we want our maps to be now, if no longer a single authoritative view of the world?
It's almost like we shouldn't use the word map anymore. It's a completely different thing. It's a completely rescalable document that can hold authoritative information, but it can also have other layers of information that are just sort of repositories of a bunch of different opinions or even conversations. That's neat, and it may play a really huge, valuable social role in the future. But the process of adjusting to that new norm is going to be really, really hairy.
John, thank you very much.
Thank you.
John Gravois is an editor at The Washington Monthly.
Coming up, a memoir of life inside the Googleplex.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives. At GatesFoundation.org, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at MacFound.org. The William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at WTGrantFoundation.org. This is NPR.
Support for this On the Media podcast comes from Audible.com, provider of digital audiobooks and more, with more than 85,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. Audible suggests that On the Media listeners might enjoy I'm Feeling Lucky, The Confessions of Google Employee 59, Ben Mesrick's Sex on the Moon, or John Hart's Iron House. To learn more about Audible and get a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/onthemedia.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Google's search algorithm revolutionized access to information on the web and has dominated the search market for more than a decade. But the company takes nothing for granted. Google's tightly protected complex formula, its secret sauce, is constantly being tweaked, both to offer better content and to lower the rankings of websites that use devious methods to manipulate search results. Google makes these tweaks unilaterally. If it decides that a website is using so-called black hat techniques to artificially boost its rankings and search results, Google has the power to essentially bury it. Matt Cutts, the head of Google's web spam team, is instrumental in making these decisions. Matt, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Now, where you come in is when Google catches people trying to game the system unethically or unfairly, cheating, basically. These people are often called black hats. Mm-hmm. Can you give me some example of black hat operations that you've had to fiddle with the algorithm to combat?
Black hat stuff can start from really simple, for example, white text on a white background, all the way to really complex, the sorts of things like viruses, malware. There are even people who will hack websites and then inject links that only search engines will see. So there's some really sneaky stuff that people will do, and people are always trying to find a way to game the system or rank higher than they deserve to rank.
White text on white background. This is so simple and so sinister. This is when you take keywords and you put them in white on white so that a computer can read them. Can you tell me what people do along those lines and why?
Absolutely. The white text might say cartoons, and then the actual content of the page could be pornographic, for example. So you don't want someone to search for a word like cartoons and land on a page that turns out to be porn. And if you're hiding text, or if you're showing different content to search engines than to users, then in some way that's deceptive because we don't get to see what a user saw.
There's been a lot of talk about content farms like demand media and associated content and others. And there has been a lot of speculation about what Google has done recently that would have a particular effect on content farms and make it harder for them to get their stories high up on Google PageRank.
In fact, we started to roll out a new change to our algorithm that tends to rank lower quality or shallow content sites lower in the search results, which ends up with higher quality sites showing up higher. We always try to have our ears open and listen to the feedback from the outside world, and that's actually something we've been working on even before people were discussing this recently.
As you go in and fiddle around the margins to keep the black hats from performing their tricks, is the algorithm getting so complicated that there's a risk of it getting away from you and no longer delivering the kind of pure results that are everybody's goal?
I wouldn't say so. Thanks to the work of a lot of engineers at Google, we've paid attention to trying to make sure that our system is maintainable, that it's understandable, and that there are good reasons for the different changes that we make.
Now, there's another issue that comes up, and that is omnipotence. You have so much market share. You are so much the only game in town at this point that you can enforce these things unilaterally without hearing or due process, putting the whole online world more or less at your mercy. Is there any process by which the people who are affected by algorithm changes and updates can make a case for themselves?
We have a webmaster forum where you can show up and ask questions, and Google employees keep an eye on that forum. And in fact, if you've been hit with a what we call a manual action, there's something called a reconsideration request, which essentially is an appeal that says, I'm sorry that I was hiding text or doing keyword stuffing, and I've corrected the problem. Could you review this? And over time, we've, I think, done more communication than any other search engine in terms of sending messages to people whose site have been hacked or who have issues, and then trying to be open so that if people want to give us feedback, we listen to that.
When you make a switch and whatever, hit send to codify it in the Google algorithm, do you and your team, you know, exchange high fives and hoot and holler because you've put another black hat out of business?
I think it's not a good idea to be completely impassioned. You don't want to act out of anger.
Yeah. Them is pretty words, Matt Cutts, and I don't disbelieve you, but there must have been at least one time when you went, take that.
Whenever you do run across someone who's especially creative and especially doing harm to users, then absolutely, it is satisfying to feel like you have made search better for everyone else. But the vast majority of the time, you really want to approach it from a centered, calm place and try to ask, what's the best thing for users? Any change will have some losses, but hopefully a lot more wins than losses.
Just doing my job, ma'am. Thank you very much.
Yeah, good talking to you.
Software engineer Matt Cutts is head of Google's web spam team.
We'll conclude the hour by flashing back to before Google was a verb, before it employed 28,000 employees worldwide, before its inventors, fellow Stanford University grad students Larry Page and Sergey Brin, who joined forces on a research project in 1996, were billionaires. Google's first office was located in a friend's garage in Menlo Park, California. By 1999, it had several dozen employees and a bright but uncertain future. That's when Doug Edwards joined on as Director of Consumer Marketing and Brand Management at Google from 1999 to 2005. His new book is called I'm Feeling Lucky, Confessions of Google Employee Number 59. Doug, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me on.
So if we can liken the maturation of a company to that of a person, what was the developmental age of Google when you joined as employee number 59? Was it 9? Was it sweet 16?
I'd go back to toddler stage. maybe the terrible twos, actually.
And as you noted, before you started at Google, you'd never heard any of the following said on the job, and I'll read a few of them. Sorry, did I get the printer? Super soakers are really inaccurate at more than 5 feet. And is there any way to set the sauna for more than half an hour? And, oh, didn't realize anyone was napping in here. And my personal favorite, who do I ask if I have a question about Windows? No one?
Well, you know, it was very different from the company I left behind, which was part of a large corporate chain. Everything was very structured. I knew exactly what my job was. I knew who I reported to and the things that I was expected to do and the things that I was not allowed to do. I got to Google and all that went out the window. It was a completely open environment, very non-hierarchical, and the assumption was that if you found a problem, you would just go ahead and fix it.
Google had grandiose dreams of saving the world. It wanted to build a company, you wrote, to fix large-scale problems affecting millions of people and terraform the entire landscape of human knowledge. They wanted to speed medical breakthroughs, accelerate the exploration of space, break down language barriers.
All of those things came from conversations I had with Larry Page, who's CEO of the company. He knew that the search engine was not the end state of what Google would be as an entity. It was the first step.
Is he where the don't be evil mantra came from?
That actually came out of one of those corporate culture feel-good meetings where a bunch of employees were gathered together to discuss mutually shared values in the company. And one of the attendees was Paul Buchheit, an engineer, and you know, he was somebody who wrote a lot of code, and as people started coming up with all these individual rules like respect other people's time and show up to meetings when you're supposed to be there, he said, we only need one rule instead of all these little ones, and that rule should be don't be evil. It just covers everything. Much more efficient. So it was originally intended as an internal guideline for people and their interactions with other Googlers, but it slipped out and became associated with the company at large.
Give me a characteristic interaction with the two founders of the company, Larry Page and Sergey Brin.
I went into a meeting to discuss some marketing on the homepage of Google, and I said, you know, here are some promotional lines that we could put on the homepage, and we could track and see if people came back more often when they saw these lines or how often they clicked on them. And they looked at each other, and Sergey said, no, I don't think this is the way to go. What we should really do is turn the homepage of Google hot pink and see what effect that has on traffic. A lot of times, the things that I thought were patently ridiculous turned out to be pretty good ideas. And I'll give the example of playing with the logo on the homepage. Sergey proposed that we toy with a logo. We put up some cartoon aliens on it. And I said, you've got to be kidding. From a branding standpoint, you don't mess with your logo. The logo is sacrosanct. And he insisted, and people actually loved having the logos change on Google.
You said that he once suggested that Google use its whole marketing budget to, quote, inoculate Chechen refugees against cholera. He said it would, quote, help our brand awareness and we'll get more new people to use Google.
Yeah, he was not a believer in traditional advertising. You know, he didn't want to go the route that everybody else did. So his idea was we'll do something that generates some great public relations for Google. It'll do some public good and everybody comes out ahead. What I came to realize is that the product really was the marketing. Google worked so much better than its competitors. So I started focusing my efforts on creating a more human face for Google's products. And that came through the language we used to talk to our users, the April Fool's jokes, and so forth.
You mentioned a desktop search engine developed by Google that indexed the hard drive of a personal computer and searched its contents. It was originally called Total Recall. But you say that that was deemed too scary. As a result, they decided to call it Fluffy Bunnies.
That was the internal code name. And we were fined, actually, if we called it Total Recall. We had to pay a dollar each time we did that.
Uh-huh.
We'd already gone through a couple of instances where people had been very concerned about the privacy implications of products Google had launched. And we really wanted to make sure that we addressed those concerns before we launched the product. There was the example of the Google toolbar, which also had the capability of scaring people because one of the features was it allowed you to see the page rank anytime you visited a new site on the internet. But to do that, Google had to look at every site you visited, which is kind of scary. So we could easily have buried notification of that feature in the licensing agreement that nobody ever reads. You know, everybody just scrolls down to the end of it and then clicks I accept. But instead, we put in this big warning message in bright red text that said, read this. It's not the usual yada yada. And then below that, it explained exactly what the feature did. So we were very cognizant of the fact that people had privacy concerns and that we needed to be upfront with them.
It's still the place where Google is most likely to be regarded as evil.
Yeah, you know, they've had some missteps. I mean, and I think the way we handled the launch of Gmail exacerbated that. People stopped trusting us so much when they felt like we were reading their email to put targeted advertising in, which was not, in fact, the case. And I think there was a real disconnect there between the founders and the engineers and the public. I talk about in the book an incident where I went to Sergey and I said, we're getting all these emails about how upset people are with the privacy issue. We need to address that. And he said, there is no privacy issue. Because in his mind, we weren't doing anything wrong. He knew that we were not reading people's email to put in these targeted ads. So if we weren't doing it, there was no issue. And we had a little bit of a discussion around perception, reality. He didn't quite get that. The fact people were upset meant that it was an issue for us.
The fact that everything you do online can be cataloged by Google and used to enable advertisers to serve us better is not a reality?
It's not something Google tries to hide. But when you go online, everything you do is tracked by machines. I mean, that's how they function. That's how they're able to give you the things that you want. So you're giving up something to get something you want. And, you know, there are some companies that are devious about how much information they collect. So you should always be careful. I mean, the example Google engineers would always give me when people complained about privacy was they think we're tracking them. What about their internet service provider? We only look at what they're doing on Google. Their internet service provider knows everything they do, every site they visit.
Yeah, but that's a deflection more than an actual addressing of the issue. It's true that the internet service providers may be even more intrusive, but that doesn't mean that what you do on Google and the fact that it can be tracked, cataloged, and utilized isn't potentially a problem.
From Google's standpoint, though, the information that's collected is used to improve the products that they're giving you. I'll give you an example. The spell checker that everybody sees on Google that says, did you mean when you misspell something?
Mm-hmm.
That uses technology that is based on what people search for. So it knows that if people search for something and then search again with an alternate spelling and then search again with yet another spelling, they probably view all those spellings as related and the last one is probably the correct one. So if they don't track the history of those searches, they're not able to use that technology to improve the spell checker. My argument was always, we should tell people we're doing this. We should let people know this is the trade-off that they're making. And Larry's answer at the time was, we don't want our competitors to know that we're using this data to improve our products. So we can't talk about it. We can't talk about the benefit people get in exchange for the privacy that they're giving up.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was an ongoing debate within the company, and I think probably still is.
Google came closest to being accused of evil when it enabled the Chinese to dictate how it functioned in that space.
In the early days, Google was able to work through problems by developing better technology. They got to China, and they tried that. They tried moving the servers to Hong Kong and doing different things, but the problem was much larger and intractable. And I think this is where Google is now as a company. They're facing much bigger, more complex problems than can be solved simply by the way engineers like to solve problems, which is, oh, let's build a new technology that will do something different. So, you know, I look at that and I see them brushing up against the real world. And I think this is going to be the future of Google. They're always going to have to deal with questions like monopoly, censorship, when often there is no perfect solution to the problem.
Doug, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me on.
Doug Edwards was Director of Consumer Marketing and Brand Management at Google from 1999 to 2005. His new book is I'm Feeling Lucky, The Confessions of Google Employee No. 59. Google co-founder Sergey Brin appeared on an episode of the game show To Tell the Truth 11 years ago. On the show, Brin and two Brin imposters were presented to a panel of celebrities who tried to figure out which one was the real one. Host John O'Hurley began by reading a statement by the real Sergey.
I, Sergey Brin, co-founded the Internet's largest search engine, Google. Not only is our site one of the hippest on the web, but our work environment at the Googleplex is heaven for employees. All right, panel and audience. These three young gentlemen all claim to be the real Google guru. Which one is it?
Number two, why is your search engine so much better than everyone else's?
Well, we return the best things first.
Number three, what's a search engine?
It's a tool used by the internet community to find other websites.
All right, time is up. Time for our celebrity panel to lock in their votes.
I voted for number three.
And I was pretty darn impressed with his technical answer, so I think it's number three.
I went with number three because I think he looks like Sergey.
Will or real, Sergey Brin, please stand up.
To everybody's surprise, number two stands up.
Number three, who are you and what do you do?
My name is R.D. Miller Jr. and I'm a professional bowler.
You stumped everybody. $5,000 will be split among the three of you. Thank you very much for playing.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Alex Goldman, DJ Vogt, Sara Abdurrahman, and Chris Neary, with more help from Emily Chin and Joe Rosenberg, and edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Rob Granis.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find transcripts at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there. You can find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. And you can email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.